Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ yāva jīvaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. When I mentioned at the little Pali verse which you say just before you give a talk, it's an old Buddhist tradition, giving some anchor to what you're going to talk about. I said that for the whole life you go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. You know what a refuge is, because that's a place you're always inclined to for your sense of peace, fulfillment. It's basically what you're about, where you go to. And as you all know, that I spent last weekend in a 5-star resort with all these big shots. And when I look back upon that, the most memorable thing which I did there was actually just waiting to be picked up, to be taken from the hotel to the ferry. Finished the breakfast early and had half an hour just sat meditation, just being peaceful. And all the things which you could have done on a resort. That's probably the only long piece of time I had to myself, except for, you know, sleeping and eating. It was a very busy time. But when it was a few minutes where you had nothing to do, that's what I did. So instead of turning on a television, instead of going into the spa, instead of walking on the beach or whatever else people do in a resort, what I wanted to do is just close my eyes and go to the resort inside, the refuge, which is what a resort really means. And it just reminds me that that's the only place which has value for us, is that peace and quiet inside. And even with all the attractions of the world, that's the place which I incline towards. And it's a wonderful thing to remember that what is the meaning of this life? What is the resort? Why are we here? And you find that you develop a refuge. And it's not a refuge just, you know, come to you, not by choice. You develop refuges in life. And in this particular monastery, there's many things you can do. There's many activities you can amuse yourself with. But sometimes you ask yourself, what is your real refuge? Or the place where you go to find peace, to find meaning. And hopefully that refuge which you find for peace, for meaning, for a sense of solidity, is closing your eyes and going inside. And you all know that from the externals of this monastery, just even the way it's built and the way that the schedule is run. I know that Ajahn Sujito argued with me that some years ago, but I stood my ground that the monastery is a community of hermits where we try and have as much time alone in seclusion as we possibly can, trying to eschew as much communal activities, especially in your younger years as a monk. Because that community of hermits is actually pushing you to find that refuge inside. And for those of you who are visiting this monastery, spending 3 months, you know, you're all doing really well, but you know that sometimes when one first comes to a monastery like this, sitting in your room with nothing to do, hour after hour after hour after hour, day after day, for some people it drives them bonkers. And they just have to go out and do something, or talk, or and those are the usual people we ask to leave the monastery because they just don't fit in here. But those people who can stay by themselves and face themselves and take refuge in themselves, be an island unto themselves, as the Buddha said, are the ones who have the refuge which is going to lead to a proper sense of peace and stillness. So just the way that we incline this monastery, and hopefully the way that I teach this monastery. Not only that, just all the other activities we do. We work in order to seclude ourselves. trying to make the buildings sort of low maintenance, so we don't have to do too much. Everything we do is trying to sort of lessen, not do more. And even those of you who do read the books, I encouraged a couple of people recently to maybe read the Theragata or the Therigata, the verses of the elders in the time of the Buddha, the elder monks, the elder nuns, the ones who got enlightened, and just hear their sort of stories. Just going off into seclusion. Here are the empty places, said the Buddha. Meditate in seclusion. And these are those wonderful beings who took that seclusion as their refuge. And so even from when we read and when we study the suttas, again, it's all pointing in the same direction, to seclusion. And you know that the two seclusions taught by the Buddha, the kaya viveka, viveka means seclusion. Kaya means body in this context. The seclusion of the body, and citta viveka, the seclusion of the mind. It's a wonderful thing to understand, like being a hermit, not just physically, but being a hermit in the mind as well. And what does that mean? Being a hermit in the body is easy to understand, because these are the beings who go to the mountains and the caves, the quiet places, the deserts maybe, and just go there and disappear and have very little contact with other people or the outside world. This is the hermit. But harder than that is the citta viveka, the hermit of the mind. And so I was just reflecting, even though that last Saturday and Sunday I was in this resort with 250 to 300 people, all CEOs or politicians or somebody famous, there I could not have so much kaya viveka, but I could always sit down and go inside and have citta viveka. Just a seclusion of the mind where you draw the senses in. You go inside, so you don't send the mind out to play in the world of seeing things. And of course in the resort, it's supposed to be one of the most beautiful places on the Great Barrier Reef. You know, when you've seen one barrier reef, you've seen them all. It's a big deal. You see one bay, the ocean, just might as well go to Cottesloe, it's much cheaper if you want to see the ocean and sand. What's the big deal? See yachts, see whales, so what? It's amazing, just sometimes it stuns me that just why people want to spend so much money to go to a place like that. When no matter how comfortable you make these resorts, it's always much more comfortable back home. It's really crazy. But anyway, with all that stuff to see and do, the most beautiful places, still, that you don't send the mind out into sights, you don't send the mind out into sounds, you don't send the mind out into other enjoyable things of the senses. You just send it inside instead. That's called citta viveka, where the mind just recedes from the world of the senses, five senses, and goes inside. And why does it do that? Because it knows that's where its refuge is. Those of you who want to get a refuge in the outside world, you know, in sights, in sounds, in pleasures of those five senses, in material things, if your refuge is in material things, you find after a while that you get very disappointed. That's one of the other interesting things of seeing all these mega-rich people at these resorts. And so often it's these people have made it in the material world, have got big mansions and I don't know how many millions of dollars in the bank. They still look at you with respect, you know, because you've given it up. And they haven't got to that stage yet. They've just made it. They haven't gone to the next stage of letting it go. It's amazing just how much respect you have, you know, when you live so simply. And understanding that means that they realize that their wealth and their power, their fame, isn't a true refuge. And so often, they look upon you with jealousy. I still remember just one of those other occasions, going to that state dinner with Queen Elizabeth in Parliament House in Canberra. And really surprised at how respectful people were to me when I was a nobody, just penniless in my robes, and all the other people were wearing incredible jewellery and really sharp suits. as you would with such a high society dinner. But sitting at a table with politicians and ambassadors, they were already looking at me and talking. I remember them saying, what a wonderful thing it is to see a monk in such an occasion, a peaceful person, somebody who's not sort of like us. I always remember them saying, you know, with sincere respect, that I had a better refuge than they did. It was a wonderful sort of little reflection there. What is your refuge? The more one seeks a refuge in the external world, just the more disappointed one gets. And of course, everyone who's come here to stay, you know, you've been there and done that to a lesser and greater degree. At least you've got the idea that there is no refuge to be found in that five-sense world. As the Buddha said, that's the realm of death, of fading away in death. All of the relationships, the possessions, the fame and stuff is just so fragile. As somebody is famous one day and they do a stupid thing, and then they're infamous the next. This is just that type of life. Sometimes you're incredibly wealthy one moment, and then the stock market crashes or someone frauds you, and then you're back on the scrap heap again. No refuge there at all. It was amazing when I went to Vietnam. The great hero of Buddhism in Vietnam was this king about 900 years ago. A king who was, of course, obviously in that society, was the very top in wealth and also in prestige. And he decided he'd had enough of being a king, and he just left and went to this holy mountain to become a monk. And I went to that mountain, and it was so remote and so austere, even in 2008, let alone what it would have been like when he was there. And that really rocked the whole nation and made many people become Buddhists. Why on earth would it be that a king at the height of his power and popularity would actually give everything away and not have the refuge in the harem, in the great food, in the power, but give all that away and find refuge just as a simple monk living in such austerity? And the amount of renunciation that fellow did was one of the main reasons, I was told, that Vietnam became a Buddhist country. It's a powerful little statement there. But it begs the question, why did he do that? It's obviously because they valued the refuge in simplicity much more than anything else. Now, it's important to understand these refuges, because if you still haven't understood it, just quite naturally you'll start to find refuges in worldly things. If it's not in books or in talking, you'll be finding refuge in studies, finding refuge in fantasizing, finding refuge in sleeping or in food. Now, there's always some things which are sort of allowable in a monastery. It's okay to do those things. It's all right to sleep. It's all right to eat. It's all right to study. It's all right to talk to one another. But, you know, is that your refuge? Is that the most valuable thing? Or is that just something you just have to do? And you get it over and done with as painlessly as possible so you can go back to your real refuge, your real home. And if one understands what the real refuge is, and you see the value of like peace and stillness and freedom of the mind, if you have enough experiences, if you're not enough experiences, enough faith, if you're not enough faith, enough wisdom coming from reading the teachings of the Buddha, or enough wisdom from listening to great monks and nuns, or enough wisdom from listening to their recorded talks to understand this is where you do find a proper refuge, a true refuge, in the stillness of your mind. If you have enough faith, enough wisdom, enough learning, then eventually, because of that faith, that wisdom, that learning, that external understanding, the mind will be inclined to search in that area. Not in the area of doing things and activities, not even in the area of trying to become enlightened or trying to get jhanas, but taking the refuge not in attainments, but taking a refuge in stillness, in calm, in settling this striving, a wanting, craving, demanding will of yours. Settling it all, calming it. So you don't want anything. I do, every now and again, have nostalgia. But that nostalgia is not for sensual things. I don't have nostalgia for my girlfriends, or nostalgia for the great movies I've read, or nostalgia for those great concerts with the Doors, or Jimi Hendrix, or Rolling Stones, which I went to as a young kid. I don't have nostalgia for that. When I have nostalgia, the one which comes up right now, was just like moments of just sitting quite coincidentally by Serpentine Lake in Hyde Park. That must have been sort of an omen for my future life, because that lake is called Serpentine Lake. Sitting by there just one lunchtime when I was doing a job during the vacation period, sitting there and just basically getting so peaceful and calm and so still, not understanding what it was. Not jhanas or anything, so I have my eyes open, but getting so calm and so still and loving that feeling so much, I had to tear myself away to get back to the work I was doing. That was what I remember with nostalgia, the peaceful, calm, still moments of my life, because that's what had greater value for me. And many people also understand this. What they really value, if they look back on their experience of this particular life, this journey in samsara, the times when they've been really still and peaceful and content and at ease, are magic times. These are those golden moments. And they're much better than the moments of great achievement or the moments of great excitement. I remember those, not the times we had sex with my girlfriend. It was the peaceful ones which are the most important ones. When I remember that, you can see just what was truly valuable. And it's the nature of the mind to take refuge in what it finds the most value in. So part of one's initial training in meditation in Dhamma is learning how to change the value system which one had in the world to the value system of a renunciant, of a monk, of a Buddhist. A Buddhist values different things in the world. Whereas those people I was with seemed to value wealth and power. Actually, talking with them, they valued what I had. The peace, the stillness, even the simple things of just my baggage. Everyone asks, is that all you have? Yeah. Where's your suitcases? I haven't got any. Wow, that's really good. I wish I could do that. And these are all these CEOs and stuff. You see, they value simplicity because every one of us knows there's something beautiful, wonderful, spiritual. A great pleasure if they could only do it. The pleasure of having little. So once you who have come here, you should at least value that amount. The value of simplicity. The value of learning how to let go of things. And once you value these things, it just changes your whole attitude towards monastic life, towards the world, towards your body, towards everything. Our idea is to throw things away. You don't keep things. You don't keep what somebody said to you, or what somebody did to you, or what stupid people just get up to in the world, or even what stupid people get up to in a monastery. As soon as it's done, just let it go. Big deal. Because you're not an accumulator. And not an accumulator of physical possessions, nor are you an accumulator of mental possessions. It's amazing just how sometimes people take refuge in their negativity. I've been wronged. I've been victimized. They can't do this to me. I won't allow them to do this to me. I'm going to stand up. They take refuge in negativity. And that becomes where they love to go every now and again, because you all know, those of you who experience negativity, when negativity you feel strong, you feel power, you've got a passion, you've got a cause. And I've seen that when you're a young man protesting against, I don't know what I protested against, didn't really make any difference, but you felt really sort of powerful and strong. Now the government can't do this to us. That's taking refuge in negativity. You see that even in some Buddhist monks even, who start tearing down, you know, Buddhism in Sri Lanka or the monks in Thailand. If you take refuge in negativity, it does give you a buzz. But it's like some sort of terrible, terrible drug, which, yeah, you get high on it, but it just really gives you a lot of sickness. It kills you, negativity. Sends you to the lower realms of existence. A quick buzz, but you descend quite deeply into some terrible states of mind. Fortunately, I don't know that the monks in this monastery anyway don't seem to get into too much negativity, at least they don't around me. Maybe you know you'll get short shrift if you start saying, ah, this monk did this or that monk did that. Yeah, just let it go. Renounce. It's just like you have few possessions, physical possessions, you have few mental possessions. You don't take refuge in the past. And of course, we don't take refuge in our hopes for the future. Where are you going after the rains retreat? And you have it all planned out and thinking about what's going to happen and how you're going to do it and where you're going to go and how you're going to travel and what's going to happen, what monasteries or what teachings or whatever. Don't plan. For those of you going on retreat, don't plan what you're going to get in your bowl. See what happens. It's much better when you really do let go of possession. You don't take refuge in these things. So you don't take refuge in the future and the past. Because there's no stillness there. You've all done that in the past. Did it really work? Did it give you anything of real value? Did it feel good? Did it really sort of cut the mustard, as they say? Long time, you all know it doesn't, but still we're stupid and we get into those stupid things again, taking refuge in our victim status, or taking refuge in how good we are, in our pride, taking refuge in all sorts of stupid external things, where we possess our experiences instead of just letting them go. We're renunciants. So I don't know who you are, where you came from, and I don't give a damn. That was past, even a moment ago. That's what we mean by acknowledging, forgiving, letting go. It's gone, done with. We don't take refuge in that. Because it's got no value. What do we take refuge? Don't even take refuge in getting enlightened tomorrow. Or getting jhana next week. Because you're going on retreat soon. Yeah, this is going to be it. Don't take refuge in the future at all. The only place you should take a refuge is now. And not just now in the experiences outside, and then now in the stillness inside. Now, deep inside is always a still point, even the old simile of the cyclone. There's always a still point in the middle. And in any place in life, there's always that still point inside which you can go to. Even in big conferences, even just sitting in the airport, just waiting for Qantas plane to go again. Another 4-hour delay on the way to Melbourne on last Thursday. You don't take refuge in the negativity. They can't do this to me. They've done it so many times. I was actually hoping that all these other CEOs, one of the ones which I was looking for was the CEO of Qantas, Jeff Dixon. I was going to buttonhole him and tell him off. But he didn't turn up. I think he probably knew what would happen to him if he did. Probably everybody else had the same experiences. But that's just negativity. That's just joking. But you can sit just waiting there, just being still, taking refuge inside. Or when you're sick in your body, don't take refuge in the sickness of the body and in the hope for being healthy in the future. If you take refuge in the promise of health, which is the doctor's delusion, I can fix you up. Come here, I'll give you a few tests, and a few more tests, and a few more tests, and endless tests. With a promise here, well, we can fix you up. You can't. It's one of the great insights which I taught the psychologists at the conference earlier, in July, whatever it was, in Sydney. be careful as someone in the healing profession. Doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, chiropractors, physios or whatever. Because sometimes you can't heal. But you can always care. It's a wonderful little understanding there. You can't heal a person often, but you can always care for them. It's a wonderful little thing there. So you never get upset that you can't cure the cancer, that you can't cure the psychosis, that you can't, you know, mend the dicky knee. But you can always care. And we caring means leaving, letting alone, being kind, being peace, being still. It's taking a refuge in Dharma, rather than taking refuge in the promise of a future of good health, which is absolutely ridiculous when you think about it. So when we understand the true refuge is, we tend to let go of these external fake refuges. You know, the ones which are like fool's gold. Maybe it looks shiny on the outside, but you investigate and there's nothing really there of substance. But you have moments of peace and moments of stillness. This is why I like monks and nuns, laymen, laywomen, to reflect. By reflecting, those are the ones you should remember. You should have nostalgia for. The time in your life when you've been most peaceful and most still, most calm. And I've actually used that as a technique of meditation. It's valid and powerful. Every now and again, don't do this every meditation. If you do it every time, it becomes just like a habitual practice, a habitual strategy. And the mind doesn't engage if it's a habit and you haven't got really any passion in what you're doing. But every now and again, you sit down, get in your meditation posture, close your eyes, just relax the body, get comfortable. And then, after 1 or 2 minutes, after closing your eyes, ask yourself, what is the most peaceful experience of my life so far? The most meaningful, the most piti sukha, the most joy, stillness, profundity. What was the most spiritual experience you've had so far? And when you remember that, fill in the details. Like you're painting the picture. Was it morning, or afternoon, or evening, or night? Where were you? Were you sitting on a chair, or on a cushion? Were you in a room, or were you outside, on a tree? I was just saying, by the Serpentine Lake in Hyde Park. Fill in it. What time of year was it? Mine was, that was in the autumn. The trees were all bare. Hardly anyone was there. It was cold. You fill in as many details as you can, because when you fill in the details of the most peaceful, calm, still experience you've ever had in your whole life, filling in the details performs a function of maintaining your focus on the peace for long enough for the mind to start resonating with that old experience. And the word, we use the word resonate because when you sort of maintain a focus on something, it does affect the mind. So when you remember the most peaceful, still, calm, beautiful experience you've ever had in your whole life, for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, longer if you have enough focus and you sustain your attention on the memory of the most beautiful experience you've had. And after 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes if you can, yeah, you drop it. But you're left with the peace, with the stillness. The mind has remembered its true refuge. And once it's reminded of it, it sticks to it. The mind remembers and the mind knows what it wants. Given half the chance, the mind will do your work and you don't need to do it at all. It's just like showing the dog the lead and it just wants to go for a walk. You don't have to kick the dog out of the door. Come on, dog. You don't have to. I suppose there are some fat, lazy dogs around in Australia these days, but when I saw people, I never had a dog myself, I've always seen people, the dog takes the owner on a walk usually, not the other way around. The dog just wants to go. And that's just like the mind. When it remembers the most beautiful experience, when it understands what's of value, when it knows what its refuge is, and you just remind it, then off it wants to go. Because I've been meditating for such a long time now that my mind knows its refuge. And sometimes all you need to do is sit down and say, off you go, mind. And it just goes by itself. Just can't stop it. Because it knows its true refuge of peace and stillness. So it's a great way of reminding yourself what this life is all about, what is valuable, what is really truthful and meaningful. And I always remember that. You just can't forget it now after 34 years as a monk, what this life is all about. It's not about fame or fortune or retreat centers or being an abbot or being a teacher. That's so superficial. My refuge is just inside. It's not even in the cave. It's inside the body which is sitting in the cave, inside its mind, in the stillness. And that keeps you spiritually sane. If you know your true refuge, it keeps all the precepts pure. Because, you know, why do people break precepts and get themselves into trouble? Simply because they think, oh, that's the refuge of happiness and peace. That's where I'll find my fulfillment. That's really interesting to find this. And you really think that there's something you're going to learn there, or something which is going to be useful for you. Okay, you might try those things, but after a while you know there's nothing really useful there. How much knowledge do you need in this world? You need very little, really, to be enlightened. In fact, you've already got more than enough knowledge. How many things do you need? You've already got too many. How many experiences do you want? Haven't you had enough yet? How many teachers do you need to visit? You actually don't need to go anywhere. Just go up in the library and there's talks for every teacher, as well as every charlatan, probably, under the sun up in that library. So you don't need to go anywhere. So why do people want to travel? Go to Hayman Island? Again, it's just land, it's just trees. No way in the world, if I was a millionaire, would I go and stay there. What's the big deal? It's all just hype. So instead, you realize the true refuge is inside, in stillness. And once you start on this journey of understanding where the true refuge is, then the mind is motivated by itself. I told this story in Hayman Island. I think this was actually to Admiral Barry, who's a former head of the defense forces and still very much involved in politics and defense and social work as well. Good man. I told him that great story about the Chinese art of war and the general who had the best discipline in the whole army, whose soldiers would always do what they were asked to do. And you know the story, I tell it many times, but it just fits in here. This general had the best discipline, his soldiers would always follow his orders. So the emperor asked him, "What's your secret?" The general replied, "Because I only tell my troops to do what they want to do. I only order them to do what they want to do already. That's why they follow orders." Makes sense, doesn't it? But the whole point of that was the general had motivated his troops, inspired them, convinced them of how wonderful it is to get up early in the morning and train. How wonderful it will be to go into battle and lay down your life for the empire or the nation or whatever. Motivation, inspiring motivation, which means he didn't have to use willpower. You can see why I keep telling that story. By motivation and inspiration, you, the general of your meditation practice, you, the general of your body and mind, you don't need to fight your mind if you know how to motivate and inspire it. You don't have to keep struggling. Come on, breath. Come on, mind. Watch the breath. Come on, mind. Let go. Come on, mind. Sit down. Come on, mind. Gee, you'd send your mind crazy. That's not the way it works. No way than any general in any army could actually force soldiers to do what they want to do. This Admiral Barry, you know, he was a not just an admiral of the Australian Navy, but you know, he's the chief of the defence forces. And he said, yeah, that's how it works, even in the real armies of Australia. That's how leadership happens. You can't force people to follow any orders, as you would know by now. And as an abbot, no way can I force you. And if I keep telling you, I become a control freak, and you all leave, or you argue with me. And of course, that just gives me a headache. You don't do it that way. You motivate, you inspire, you lead. You don't order. And when you know that, that's how you meditate. You inspire the mind. You motivate it by little things like remembering the most peaceful experience. By reminding yourself what the refuge is. You know, by inspiring yourself the beautiful refuges, you know, the hermit, the peace, the stillness, the freedom, you know, the bliss better than sex or whatever. These are things which start to motivate and inspire people. It's part of my job, but it's also part of your own job to inspire and motivate yourself so you know what your real refuge is in life, especially in monastic life. To get to that refuge, to inspire yourself, yeah, you can use thinking, use your wisdom and reflection. You're going to all die, you're getting sick, you know, you're falling apart already. Even this 3 months range retreat, you know, you just notice how you're losing it. I call it Ajahn Brahmani, forgot something, couldn't remember it. You're getting old. The brain cells are decaying and disappearing. Even during this talk, I don't know how many hundreds of brain cells have disappeared in each one of you. Your intellectual capability has decreased since the beginning of this talk. It's going to get worse. You're on the downward slope. So say things like that. I mean, you just... You can't take refuge in this world. You can't take refuge in your body. It's amazing, just all these people who just die so quickly. You know, just had those cases, the 4-year-old kid just died. You know, and Venerable Charter did his funeral service. One of the guys here, Brian, 58 years of old, just woke up in the morning dead. You know, just... If you know what I mean. Actually, he did wake up in the morning. But actually, I think he did wake up. I think they said he woke up, sort of he hugged his wife, and then he died. So he woke up in the morning and died. He wasn't woke up dead, yeah. I know what I said. I'm glad you're paying attention. Yeah, I can't even take refuge in my own intelligence. I say stupid things like that. But what can you take refuge in? So when you start contemplating and use your intelligence, use your rational mind, what it does, it just cuts away all these things which are false refuges. Places where you can't stand. You can't set up a happy home. There's no place you can retire there and live happily ever after. It's not a refuge for you. So where can you live happily ever after? Where can you retire? Where can you sort of hang up your boots and say, this is my home, now I'm okay, I don't need anything else? What are you aspiring for? What refuge are you trying to get to? Think like that, reflect like that, use the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, use the Theravada, the voice, the words of these enlightened elders. Use the examples of the Kubo Ajahns. Use the examples of people you know who've made it, who have some peace and stillness. And then you know what your refuge is. And then when you inspire yourself, you motivate yourself, you remind yourself, this is the value, this is the only thing I really am inclining towards. It's the only thing which is worthwhile, the only thing which is meaningful. And everything else is just a fantasy, just a phantom, not real at all. When you understand that and know that, then the mind will always incline eventually to that which it finds valuable. Sure, it will go on a few detours, you know, just the echoes of bad habits. That's what I call echoes of bad habits, you know, thoughts about stupid things. You know, maybe sloth and torpor, a bit of restlessness or fantasy or whatever, but you know, the mind is, okay, you know, I've had that, done that, a bit of playtime over, now let's get to the real thing, the real refuge of peace and stillness. The great thing about the refuge of peace and stillness and freedom is that when you just get a little bit of it, a little sense of stillness and peace, it just starts to grow in momentum. When you start to take refuge inside, in the silence, in the peace, in the calming of the will of the doer, of the controller. You're settling it down so you just leave things alone and don't control anything at all. It gets even more delicious. You're on the path of delicious meditation, letting go, the path of Dhamma, in, because that's where the juicy parts lie. The deeper you go in, not just the more blissful, but the more profound it is. Sometimes, you know, I don't know what if there is a word for it. You get deep pithi sukha in the meditation, but there's another aspect to that. It's not just joy and peace for joy's sake. There's a sense of, you know, this is profound, this is deep, this is something which is leading to nibbana. And the deeper you go, the more you know you're getting there. It's like digging a well. When you're digging a well, you go deeper and deeper, and then, you know, the earth starts to become moist. And you dig deeper, then it starts to become soggy. You know you're in the right direction. Dig a bit deeper, then you've got the water. You know, just that, from being damp to being soggy to actually having water you can take out. That's just like, as you go deeper in meditation. You know, first of all, it gets damp with Dhamma, as you were, if you like, damp with meaning. It sort of tastes of freedom, of nibbana, of the ultimate. You're getting closer and you can smell it. You can see the light at the end of the tunnel. You know you're going in the right direction. It's more and more profound. That profundity of the experience is not to be dismissed, because that's even more important than the bliss and the peace. It's meaning. The deeper you go, the more meaningful it becomes. So these become the most meaningful, profound, important experiences of your whole life. And because the mind recognizes that, naturally, without you needing to tell it, the mind knows that this is what it's all about. And it goes more, it wants more, it just inclines more, it leans more into those states. Just as in the similes of the Buddha, just as the Ganges and all these other rivers, they incline, they lean, to the ocean. Just so that you incline and lean towards Nibbana if you follow this path. You incline towards even more simplicity, more stillness, more freedom, more peace, more calming, stilling of this control of this doer. This control of this doer, you can link it. Another way of looking at it is the asavas. It takes you out. Whenever you do something, you go somewhere else, other than where you are. So doer moves you, propels you. It's a jet engine at your backside which pushes you over there or pushes you somewhere else. But when that doer, that will, that choice, that controller is calmed and settled, then you get very still. You don't go anywhere. The gas of your car has been turned off. So just comes to a halt. When you run out of gas, or petrol as they say, yeah, it's still going, but it's slower and slower and slower and slower. It's only a matter of time before you come to a complete stop. That's like meditation. When you know where the petrol switch is, and you turn that one off, you're going to be pushing the accelerator down, but nothing works. The engine's stopped. So the engine is this controller, this doer, this me, this idea of who you are, always wants to make things happen, get here, want this. That's all coming from this ego, this sense of self. So calming the doer is actually diminishing your identity. And the more you calm it down, the more you let things be. You're kind, you're gentle. These are all brilliant words of saying, shut up and do nothing. Being kind to something means you accept it for what it is. You don't want to change it. That's what kind is, opening the door of your heart to this moment, as it is. Unconditional mindfulness. A mindfulness which doesn't want to change or alter anything. a mindfulness which doesn't want to get somewhere else, even if it's a beautiful place to be, a mindfulness which wants just to stop this very thing which wants to attain, a mindfulness which sees his mind moving towards wanting even wholesome things, a mind which sees it's a wanting is a problem, the negativity, the wanting to get somewhere else or get rid of. That's what the mindfulness sees. And it doesn't want to get rid of the wanter and make more complications for this Western mind. What it needs to do is just to calm down. Come on, settle down, mind. Remember that still peaceful experiences of the past. And the mind knows that. And it just inclines. It doesn't go out anymore into the world of thoughts and fantasies and memories and dreams and plans. And doesn't go out and listening to sounds or building monasteries or building retreat centers or traveling. It doesn't go out into fixing the problems of the world. It goes in instead. You never go on to the next stage in any meditation. You go into the next stage. The next stage of peace is right in the center of where you are right now. And don't go on anywhere. Don't go backwards. Don't go forwards. Go inwards. Into the moment. Into silence. Into the breath. Into the moment. Always going inwards. Which is the opposite direction of what constitutes a self and its doing and playing in the world. It goes against the stream of craving. The Buddha said, an inward path. So you don't actually go anywhere to go inwards. You don't go forward, you don't go back, you don't go left, you don't get right. You stay where you are, and you go inwards. Like a balloon deflating, gets smaller and smaller, but even more than that, like a black hole, sucking everything and going deep inside to a place where you can't get out of. That's what happens in this meditation practice. And how does it happen? Because our whole momentum is going for refuge in the stillness, in the peace, in the freedom, in the emptiness of everything. That becomes one's refuge. The deeper you go, the more you feel that the whole path is just almost like a fulfillment of the letting go. A further experiencing of the spiritualness of having nothing. Of really being the hermit. Really being the one with no possessions at all. Not even possessing a possessor. It's completely empty. To the core. When there's no one in here, there's nothing to own. That's the place, the only place. You get the hint, the message. That this is what Nibbana is. This is what Dhamma is. This is what the point is. This is what the whole purpose of the path is. This is your refuge. The only refuge. In emptiness and stillness. When there's something there, there's always going to be change. There's always going to be movement. There'll never be stillness. So there'll always only be suffering. You might even say that dukkha is movement. The Buddha actually said, you know, the arahat is just suffering arising and suffering and passing away. Arising and passing away is the suffering. Movement is dukkha. The only way to end dukkha is to have stillness. When nothing moves. When nothing arises and passes away. But that means you can't control anything. You can't change anything. Because that's what control is. Control is what changes things. What alters? Now you're not going to changing and altering anymore. You're going to stillness, to peace, to the freedom of that pressure to go somewhere else. So nice, you know, when I come back from all these travels, to go into my heart and know today I don't have to go anywhere. Today I can rest and relax in my own monastery. It's great next week when I'm on retreat. I can relax in my cave. I don't need to go even down to the dining hall to get my lunch. It'll all be set up to me. Don't have to go anywhere. When I meditate, I can sit there. I don't have to go anywhere to figure out the itinerary for my next trip. to see what's necessary for the retreat center. In my cave, I don't go anywhere. I stay in the cave. When I meditate, I just go in my mind. Don't go anywhere. It's like being at home. You sit down in the most comfortable place, and I've got no appointments, nowhere to go, nothing to achieve, nothing to change, no business. Oh, that's bliss. That's a refuge. It's a beautiful refuge. You know, a refuge has to be a comfortable place to stay. A beautiful place to stay. Otherwise, what sort of refuge is it? You can't say refuge is Guantanamo Bay, where you get tortured all the time. That's not a refuge. A refuge is a place of safety and peace and happiness and freedom. Where can a refuge be? Samsara is Guantanamo Bay, enlarged. You just get tortured, you get put in jails. They're imprisoned by your cravings. imprisoned by your negativity, by your anger, which makes you say terrible things to the people you should really be respecting. Oh, this is torture. It's no refuge. So the real refuge is deep inside. Buddha said that. Great monks and nuns say that. And you have enough nous, enough experience to know that that's true. Little by little, you seek refuge where there is a true refuge. And as quiet as you can become, that would be your first refuge. And underneath that, in the center of that, in the middle of that, you'll find a deeper refuge, and a deeper refuge, and a deeper refuge. Deeper and deeper in. Yeah, that's meditation, but that's also the insight into what Nibbana actually is. What is freedom? What is peace? It's amazing, people like to have peace. They like to go and retreat. And it was amazing. They call this conference on the weekend a leadership retreat. And it wasn't a retreat at all, not the way I understand retreats, where you can have a rest and be quiet inside. And people were talking all the time, just doing what they always do, except, you know, together rather than in their own offices. So that's not a retreat. For me, it would be much better to call it what it was, a conference. However, to retreat, you have to go back from the world. Retreat from your normal things which you do. Retreat from the five senses. Retreat from your will. Retreat, going back in, so you can leave the world. Please remember that, because I found that so useful in my own practice and so helpful for teaching others. Your job in meditation is not to go on to the next stage. Stay where you are, just go deeper into it. Stop all this movement, all this agitation, all this disturbing by your will and controlling. Control takes you somewhere else. Will moves you away. It stops you settling down. That's why you have to learn how to let go, be kind, be gentle, just renounce. But renounce this thing inside which is always messing things up. And then all these jhanas, they just happen. All these nimittas, they just occur. Your mind remembers these things. Yeah, you get there once, but the mind remembers these things. So that's my refuge. That's where I belong. That's my home. Deep inside. Once you have a home, a real home, a proper refuge, just like any other Australian, you got your home, you can go out to work and do things for the world, but you've always got a home to come back to at any time. A home you hang out in to replenish all of your energy so you can go back into the world and give it your all if necessary. But you know that world is not your home. It's not your refuge. No more than the factory or the building site is the bricklayer's home. It's just a place they go to. Their refuge, their home is somewhere else. In the same that you may do the office work, clean the toilets, do the upatak duties or whatever else you have duties to do in this monastery, but that is not your home. Your home is deep inside. Even your kuti, that is not your home. The home is deep inside your mind. It's the only refuge which anyone really has. So when you say that I go to refuge the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, that's what it really means. The refuge in stillness, in emptiness, taking refuge in letting go, renouncing, refuge in kindness, in gentleness, refuge in the path and the goal, where nothing moves, the only home you can ever have. So that's taking refuge. It's the last talk I'm going to give for 3 weeks here, because I'm going to go inside my cave on Saturday evening and just take refuge in there. Have a wonderful time. Please be inspired to follow me, not into my cave, but into your cave. Not the physical cave. The Hadaya Guha, said the Buddha, the cave of the heart, deep inside your body, deep inside your mind. And best of luck, and see you there. That's the talk. Very good.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sankhanna.